Have you ever wondered why the same event can be described in completely different ways? After the September 11th attacks, a $3.5 billion insurance dispute hinged on whether the tragedy constituted one event or two. This semantic battle wasn't merely academic. It revealed something profound about how human minds organize reality. Steven Pinker's The Stuff of Thought explores this fascinating intersection between language and cognition, offering a window into the human mind unlike any other. Since its 2007 publication, the book has become required reading in cognitive science programs worldwide and counts among the favorite books of tech luminaries like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. Pinker, a Harvard professor whose TED Talks have garnered millions of views, masterfully bridges linguistics, psychology, and philosophy to reveal how our everyday speech, from casual conversations to legal disputes to profanity, unveils the hidden architecture of human thought. When terrorists attacked the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, they unwittingly created not just a national tragedy, but a fascinating semantic problem. Was this one event, a terrorist plot, or two events, separate plane crashes? For the leaseholder of the buildings, this distinction meant the difference between a $3.5 billion or $7 billion insurance payout. This seemingly straightforward question reveals how human minds carve continuous reality into discrete conceptual units. This semantic dispute illustrates a fundamental aspect of human cognition. We don't simply perceive reality, we actively organize it through mental frameworks that are reflected in our language. Some people define the events physically, two tower collapses, while others define them by human intentions, one terrorist plot. Neither perspective was factually wrong. They simply represented different ways of mentally packaging the same reality. The 9/11 example demonstrates how the mind organizes both space and time through parallel conceptual structures. We treat events remarkably like objects. They can be counted, divided, and relocated. We say things like, the meeting was moved forward, just as naturally as the car was moved forward, revealing how deeply our understanding of time borrows from our understanding of space. These aren't just linguistic quirks. They reflect our fundamental cognitive architecture, the conceptual frameworks through which we comprehend the world. When Republicans frame taxes as confiscations, while Democrats describe them as membership fees, they aren't just playing word games. They're activating entirely different mental models that shape how people perceive reality. This ability to frame situations differently powers intellectual creativity, humor, and social discourse. It's what allows us to see the same glass as half empty or half full, to reinterpret experiences in ways that help us cope with trauma, or to find novel solutions to stubborn problems. But it also fuels political disputes, where competing descriptions battle for legitimacy. The words we choose aren't just labels for pre-existing concepts, they actively shape how we think about the world. When President Bush claimed the British had learned about Saddam seeking uranium, he wasn't just reporting information. The verb learn is factive. It entails that the belief attributed is true, unlike verbs like think or believe. This semantic distinction carried enormous weight, potentially making the difference between honesty and an impeachable offense that helped justify a devastating war. Have you ever wondered why certain words make people wince or gasp? Words soak up emotional coloring far beyond their literal meanings, acquiring connotations that range from attractive to deeply offensive. Bertrand Russell captured this perfectly in his formula: I am firm, you are obstinate, he is pig-headed. The same quality gets labeled differently depending on our relationship to the person being described. This emotional saturation is especially evident in profanity. Why do unpleasant events trigger references to sexuality, excretion, or religion? It's a puzzling linguistic phenomenon that seems to emerge from ancient brain systems yet conforms to modern language patterns. Taboo words carry awesome powers across cultures. Orthodox Jews never speak God's name directly, instead referring to Hashem, the name. English oddly lacks polite terms for universal bodily functions and transitive verbs for sex. These linguistic taboos persist despite their illogic. The same government that punished George Carlin for mentioning banned words on radio passed the Broadcast Decency Enforcement Act on the same day Vice President Cheney used profanity on the Senate floor. Even those who question linguistic taboos typically respect some word boundaries, as with the N-word, suggesting word magic is fundamental to human psychology rather than merely prudish censorship. The emotional power of words extends beyond taboos to names. When naming a child, most people select established names rather than inventing new sounds, despite having rare freedom to designate an entity with a word of their choosing. Names acquire meaning through association with generations and social classes. American readers would likely guess that someone named Murray is over 60, middle class, and probably Jewish, a demographic insight Leon Wieseltier referenced when commenting on Mel Gibson's anti-Semitic tirade. Beyond their emotional resonance, words operate simultaneously on multiple levels beyond literal meaning. Consider the clever gate agent who deflated a pompous passenger's "Do you have any idea who I am?" with a public announcement seeking help identifying someone who doesn't know who he is. We constantly communicate indirectly, making requests as questions, offering veiled bribes, making sexual come-ons, or delivering threats through transparent euphemisms. These verbal charades aren't meant to truly deceive. Both parties recognize the real intent while maintaining a veneer of deniability. This indirection serves crucial social functions, allowing us to navigate relationships without explicitly acknowledging power dynamics. Ordinary conversation resembles diplomatic negotiations, where face-saving, plausible deniability, and subtle signaling help manage the complex mix of power, sex, intimacy, and fairness between people. Like Alice stumbling into Wonderland, exploring the seemingly mundane problem of how children learn verbs reveals a hidden microcosm of basic human ideas and their connections. Children's language acquisition represents an astonishing feat of induction. From finite samples of speech, they extract infinite generative rules. Within just 3 years, without formal instruction, children develop vocabularies of thousands of words and command complex grammatical structures. Their errors, like "all animals are wake-upped," reveal they're not merely imitating but analyzing language systematically. This represents a profound solution to what philosophers call the induction problem, deriving universal principles from limited examples. Verbs present a particularly fascinating puzzle. Beyond the basic distinction between intransitive verbs like snore and transitive verbs like sprain, English has verbs requiring oblique objects, sentence complements, and other patterns, with thousands of verbs falling into dozens of classes. A verb determines not just word order, but meaning. Contrast "Barbara caused an injury" with "Barbara sustained an injury." Children learning language face a puzzling challenge with verb constructions. When encountering verbs like "load," they discover these verbs can appear in multiple constructions, like "load hay into the wagon" and "load the wagon with hay." This pattern appears with other verbs like "spray," "splash," and "rub," suggesting a rule where content locative constructions can alternate with container locative constructions. Yet many verbs resist this alternation. Pour works in "pour water into the glass," but not "pour the glass with water," while "fill" works in "fill the glass with water," but not "fill water into the glass." The paradox deepens because children do generalize, creating novel constructions like "can I fill some salt into the bear?" They aren't simply memorizing verb construction pairings, nor are they consistently corrected when they overgeneralize. The breakthrough in solving this paradox came when linguists reconceived the problem not as phrase manipulation, but as a conceptual gestalt shift. The two constructions represent fundamentally different event construals. The content locative, "load hay onto the wagon," means A causes B to go to C, while the container locative, load the wagon with hay, means A causes C to change state by means of causing B to go to C. This elegant solution reveals how deeply perspective-taking is embedded in language. Even in describing simple physical actions, we can frame events in different ways. This framing difference explains the holism effect. When something is expressed as a direct object, it's interpreted as wholly affected. The pattern reveals how English treats changing entities similarly to moving entities, conceptualizing states as metaphorical state space, demonstrating the pervasive role of metaphor in everyday language. When speakers instinctively avoid certain verb constructions or wince at others' usage, they're demonstrating sensitivity to subtle semantic distinctions that are never explicitly taught. This sensitivity suggests people represent verbs in memory such that those with similar syntactic behaviors share overlapping definitions in an abstract language of thought. This mental language must be highly abstract to group verbs by their conceptual structure rather than surface similarities. For example, hand, carry, and bring might look similar in the physical world, but syntactically they behave differently because they represent different conceptual categories. Similarly, baking a cake is conceptually grouped with building a house, creation verbs, rather than with warming a cake, state change verbs. While specific constructions aren't universal across languages, similar patterns repeatedly emerge worldwide. Locative alternations appear in languages from German to Japanese to Bantu languages. Dative constructions exist on every continent, and causative alternations number in hundreds of languages. When these constructions appear, they typically follow the same conceptual scripts, like the holism effect in container locatives. Certain fundamental concepts consistently emerge across languages. Basic entities, event, state, thing, path, relationships, acting, going, being, having, taxonomies of entities, spatial concepts, time, causation, and goals. These form the major words in our language of thought, a conceptual scaffolding with hooks for hanging images, sounds, emotions, and other contents of consciousness. Brain studies support this distinction between core grammatical concepts and richer meanings. Patients with certain brain damage lose ability to distinguish similar verbs, like drip from pour, while retaining sensitivity to their grammatical behavior, while others show the opposite pattern. The fundamental concepts that structure our language, causation, force, time, and substance, aren't universal logical necessities, but evolved mental tools that sometimes fail us in modern contexts. Several examples illustrate these limitations. Having and benefiting. Though we conceptualize well-being as possession, rich is better, research confirms that beyond basic affluence, additional wealth brings little additional happiness. Having and knowing. The conduit metaphor treats knowledge as objects we possess and transmit, but cognitive science shows this misleads us. Memory doesn't store information like objects on shelves, but actively reconstructs it, often inaccurately. Time. Language packages time into discrete events rather than continuous flow, missing the notion of time as a measurable commodity, perhaps explaining cultural clashes between hurried post-industrial societies and more lackadaisical approaches to time. Causality. Our prototype of causation involves direct intentional action, but real-world causality often involves complex chains of events that challenge legal concepts of responsibility, as in cases where someone indirectly causes harm. George Lakoff, former student of Chomsky and founder of cognitive linguistics, represents the strongest advocacy for what might be called the metaphor. In his view, metaphor isn't mere linguistic ornament, but essential to thought itself. Our ordinary conceptual system is fundamentally metaphorical in nature. Lakoff makes radical claims based on this premise. Since we think in metaphors grounded in physical experience rather than logical formulas, he argues the entire Western philosophical tradition is misconceived. He rejects objective truth, seeing only competing metaphors that serve different purposes. He reframes Western philosophy as a succession of conceptual metaphors, mathematics as bodily-based rather than eternal truth, and political ideologies as rival versions of the society is a family metaphor. But people can transcend metaphors in their language rather than being trapped by them. Experimental psychologists like Kesar and Glucksberg have shown that people don't access the underlying conceptual metaphor when processing conventional metaphorical expressions. Only when metaphors are fresh and unconventional do readers activate the underlying conceptual mapping. We can question, discount, and analyze metaphors, even joke about them, as in Stephen Wright asking, "If all the world's a stage, where is the audience sitting?" This ability to analyze metaphors reveals that we must possess an underlying medium of thought more abstract than the metaphors themselves. When reasoning with metaphors like love is a journey, we focus on relevant aspects, shared destinations, progress, while ignoring irrelevant ones, packing luggage, gas stations. Beneath metaphors lie abstract conceptual skeletons identified by Jackendoff and Gruber. Concepts like thing, path, goal, and force that maintain connections to physical reasoning but function as abstract symbols. These concepts support inference across domains. If we understand how objects move in space, we can apply similar reasoning to possession, time, or states. The usefulness of metaphors comes from their analogical structure. They support reasoning of the form A is to B as X is to Y. This explains why metaphors are metaphors we live by, enabling sophisticated inferences like the engineers who solved synthetic paintbrush problems by reconceiving brushes as pumps. How do we read between the lines in conversation? Philosopher Paul Grice explained this through his theory of conversational implicature. When a reviewer writes that a performer produced a series of sounds that corresponded closely with the score, we understand it as criticism because the verbose phrasing deliberately avoids the simpler word sang. Grice proposed that conversation follows a cooperative principle governed by four maxims: quantity, say just enough; quality, be truthful; manner, be clear and brief; and relevance. Politeness theory explains how people navigate social interactions through language. Anthropologists Brown and Levinson showed that people worldwide worry about maintaining face, both positive face, the desire to be approved, and negative face, the desire for autonomy. These reflect fundamental social dualities: solidarity, status; connection, autonomy; intimacy, power. Most speech threatens the hearer's face somehow. Simply starting a conversation demands attention. Commands challenge autonomy. Requests risk refusal. We compensate with politeness strategies: sympathy, simulating closeness through phatic expressions like "how are you," and deference, acknowledging the hearer's autonomy. Game theory helps explain why people use indirect speech in situations of conflict or uncertainty. Consider a driver deciding whether to bribe an officer after being pulled over. A direct bribe, "I'll pay you $50 to let me go," creates a risky binary outcome. If the officer is corrupt, the driver avoids a ticket. If honest, the driver gets arrested for bribery. Using an indirect bribe, "maybe the best thing would be to take care of it here," creates a safer third option. A corrupt officer understands the implied bribe, while an honest officer can't prove bribery beyond reasonable doubt. The indirect approach combines the advantage of bribing a dishonest cop with minimal risk when facing an honest one. Why does bribing a maitre d' feel unethical when we readily pay for expedited service elsewhere? Anthropologist Alan Fisk explains this through his theory of human relationships, which identifies three fundamental types. The first is communal sharing, where what's mine is thine. This relationship naturally exists among blood relatives due to evolutionary advantages, but also extends to couples, friends with shared interests, and others with common goals. Communality isn't calculated through genetic relatedness, but experienced as emotional warmth and conceptualized through metaphors. Solidarity is physical closeness. Solidarity is being connected. And, most powerfully, solidarity is being made of the same flesh. Since pure communality is vulnerable to exploitation, groups employ mind control techniques to strengthen communal bonds. These include kinship metaphors, brotherhood, sisterhood, shared meals and food taboos, blood mingling rituals, distinctive body modifications, and synchronized movements that create the sensation of being part of a single communal body. Why do we bother with transparent pretenses in social interactions? When the maitre d'hôtel knows he's being bribed, the donor knows he's being solicited, and everyone understands a sexual overture, why does keeping these intentions off the record matter if the deniability wouldn't pass the giggle test? This puzzle emerges when two conditions are met. Both parties know each other's intentions, and the implicature is so obvious that there's no real doubt about what was intended. In a courtroom, even a scintilla of deniability might matter legally, but why do we act like defense lawyers in everyday life? The phenomenon reveals something specific to language itself. Expressing a sentiment baldly, on record, in so many words, makes a psychological difference. Some things once said can never unsaid. Several explanations might account for this peculiar human tendency. 1. The token bow. By using indirect speech, a speaker signals they're making an effort to spare the hearer's dignity or face. This consideration itself eases feelings all around, while a bald proposition signals no such effort. 2. Don't talk at all, show me. Communal relationships aren't negotiated verbally, but consecrated through physical signs, like rituals and bodily contact. The very act of articulating a relationship in words signals it can't be communal, since true communal bonds are felt, not rationally decided. 3. The virtual audience. While participants may understand an indirect proposition perfectly, eavesdroppers or third parties hearing about it secondhand have only the actual words to go on. We may always be performing for this imagined audience. 4. Preserving the spell. The public relationship is a pleasant illusion. The maitre d'hôtel reigning over his fiefdom, a woman enjoying a man's intellectual interest, a donor enjoying conviviality with prestigious people. This illusion can survive an implicated message, but would be shattered by a bald proposition. 5. Certainty as a focal point. Relationship types represent discrete, very different modes of interaction, and switching between them requires joint recognition. A bald proposition clearly falls on one side of the line, while innuendo exists on a continuum. Even if the plausibility of denial is tiny, as long as it isn't absolutely zero, as with a bald proposition, it provides a clear boundary for maintaining the current relationship. Language is fundamentally social. We choose words carefully to both convey intentions and maintain relationships. But is our avoidance of plain speaking a design flaw, or might it serve a deeper purpose? The paradox of rational ignorance suggests that even if our brains could process unlimited information perfectly, there are certain messages a rational mind might deliberately avoid receiving. Knowledge isn't always power. Sometimes it's poison. Our minds impose a causal texture on the world that goes beyond mere temporal sequence. When my PDA chimes a minute before my alarm clock blares each morning, I never perceive the chime as causing the alarm despite their reliable sequence. Instead, I attribute the alarm to my button pressing the night before, a cause separated by hours with an uncertain mechanism and occasional failures. Space, time, and causality form the fundamental infrastructure of our experience, yet they're riddled with paradoxes. I cannot imagine an elephant without spatial properties. It must occupy space somewhere, even if floating in my mind's eye. Similarly, we can imagine empty time, but not events outside of time. Space itself presents a logical paradox. It must be either finite or infinite, yet neither possibility sits well with intuition. These paradoxes led Kant to conclude that space, time, and causality aren't properties of reality itself, but structures imposed by our minds. They organize our experience rather than being abstracted from it. We grasp the world only through these mental frameworks, which harmonize with reality well enough for science to be possible, but prevent us from knowing the world in itself. Kant's conceptual scaffolding that organizes our experience is conspicuously reflected in language structure. Rather than being organized around sensory experiences or human obsessions like food or sex, languages are structured around abstract Kantian categories: substance in nouns, space in prepositions, causality and time in verbs. We see this in everyday metaphors too. Prices rising like balloons, cities being an hour apart as if they were alarm clocks. This isn't to say Kant is a reliable guide to our current understanding of thought and reality. Modern physics contradicts our intuited experience of space and time, showing space to be warped, possibly 11-dimensional, and riddled with black holes. Time may be just the fourth dimension of a static space-time. Many physicists say space and time as empty media don't exist at all. Yet two Kantian ideas remain invaluable. His synthesis of empiricism and rationalism, the mind contributes abstract conceptual frameworks that organize experience but must be filled with sensory content, and his characterization of space and time as media in which sensations are arrayed. Humans transform the analog flow of sensation into discrete objects and events, packaging experience into propositions about real and possible worlds. These characterizations are schematic, highlighting certain aspects while ignoring others, allowing multiple construals of the same physical situation. Our mental inventory begins with basic units: events, states, things, substances, places, goals, and specifies how these units interact through actions like causing, enabling, and preventing. We distinguish individuals from categories, essences from superficial properties, and substances from bounded objects. Our primitive number concept distinguishes only one, two, and many, yet applies across quantities, space, and time. Nouns reflect profound distinctions in how we mentally represent entities, particularly through the count-mass distinction. Count nouns like pebble refer to bounded objects that can be enumerated, while mass nouns like gravel refer to substances without clear boundaries. The grammar enforces these distinctions. We say two pebbles, but not two gravels, a pebble, but not a gravel, and much gravel, but not much pebble. Spatial terms quantize space at points where causal events change dramatically on either side. The point at which we say a marble is in rather than on a hand corresponds to the curvature that prevents it from rolling off when jiggled. A rope around a pole can do things a rope merely by the pole cannot. Such distinctions can be literally life-saving, as when a miscommunication about whether someone fell on versus through ice fatally delayed rescue workers. Time is the essential fabric of consciousness. While we might imagine existing without space, as if in sensory deprivation, we cannot conceive of awareness without time. Despite claims to the contrary, all human cultures have conceptions of time. No society exists where people would be unsurprised by someone aging backward. Causality, as Hume noted, is the cement of the universe. Our intuitive understanding of causation goes beyond simple correlation or counterfactual theories, involving a sense of oomph, some force or energy transmitted from cause to effect. Kant was right that our minds cleave the air with concepts of substance, space, time, and causality. These concepts form the foundation of conscious experience and provide the semantic content for major syntactic elements: nouns, prepositions, tense, and verbs. They give us the mental vocabulary to reason about physical and social worlds. However, when examined through language, these concepts differ significantly from what Kant imagined. rather than matching reality perfectly, they are gadgets in the brain that present paradoxes when pushed to the frontiers of science, philosophy, and law. They are digital, where the world is analog, schematic, where reality is rich, vague, where precision is needed, and parochial, to human interests, when objectivity is required. Though it may be humbling to see the foundations of common sense as merely design specifications of an organ, our science and reason have managed to reveal aspects of substance, space, time, and causality that transcend common sense. This scrutiny of concepts as they appear in language allows us to understand them as part of our makeup and discount them accordingly, coming as close as possible to the light dove's dream of taking wing in empty space.